our talk now more directly about emotional intelligence, okay? So how does emotional intelligence, what does that have to do with frontal lobe, with the brain? Actually, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but emotional intelligence, it's more important in certain ways than what we call EQ is emotional intelligence. IQ is your analytical intelligence, you know, that people usually measure, right, for success, how smart you are, you have a high IQ. We know that for people actually to be successful in life, they don't necessarily need a high IQ, but they do need a high EQ, emotional quotient, emotional intelligence. And the nice thing is that people, most people, once you measure your IQ, that's it. There's not much you can do. Of course, yes, when you're growing up and you're developing your body, your brain, there's a strong genetic correlation of your parents' IQ to your IQ. But the nice thing is with EQ, with emotional intelligence, even if you're not good at it or you don't have a high EQ, you can still learn and improve your emotional intelligence. We know that many studies have shown, like I just said, that people that are successful in what they do, many times they have a high EQ, high emotional intelligence. I don't know how it is here, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's not different. In the U.S., you know that all of the U.S. presidents, they haven't had necessarily a high IQ, but all of them had a high EQ, a high emotional intelligence quotient. Why? We're going to learn why. People that have a high EQ, they think clearly. They have very clear thinking process. They have very effective communication. There's no gaps. They're able to express what they feel. They're able to communicate what they mean. People that have high EQ, they promote unity in a group, even though they may disagree or have different concepts of thinking, they still are able to keep their polarizing statements to the minimum, and they're able to build consensus with people from different diverse ideas without compromising the truth. That is a skill and requires emotional intelligence. What impacts emotional intelligence? First, your childhood experience. As you grow up, how, you know, the messages that you hear from your parents, the foods that you eat, all impact you. The level of emotional support you had and you have currently. That if you have good emotional support for family, friends, church, community, you improve or you make, you know, that helps to increase your emotional quotient, your emotional intelligence. Also, we know that lack of sleep decreases emotional intelligence. And you all probably experience that. When you are sleepy and you're tired, you just get irritated easily, you're not able to communicate well, and you can clearly see this. Poor nutrition decreases your emotional intelligence. And this is a very interesting study that was done in California. Can you see the picture well from the back, or you want the light off like we had earlier? Is that okay? All right. They looked at these prisoners in California, and they decided that they were going to do an experiment. They're going to try a vegetarian diet, and whoever was willing to try it, and see if that would, you know, help to decrease the problems. You know how it is in a prison. There's a lot of fights, a lot of problems that are created, conflicts among the amid them. So they put this group that was willing to try a nice plant-based diet, and then they did that for about 3 months, and then they looked at how they reacted afterwards. The control group was the one that was eating anything, and the one, you know, meats and sugars and all the things that they serve. And this other group was just on a plant-based diet. They found out after 3 months that the people that were eating a plant-based diet, they had more serotonin and more emotional control in stressful situations. So the levels of conflict among that group decreased tremendously as compared to the group that was on a regular diet. Also, this guy, Terry Moreland, he was known then because of this, and they started incorporating and offering and suggesting and actually encouraging the prisoners to eat a plant-based diet, and they decreased the amount of violence in that prison because of that. So we know that that happens. Now, also, the illness may decrease because your immune system goes up when you have more emotional intelligence. The major one, your beliefs, your evaluation of events, and your self-talks, what you tell yourself. You know, you're not speaking out loud, but anytime you're going to do something, you get up in the morning, what am I going to wear today? You're not speaking, but you're thinking. If something bad happens to you, you tell yourself something. Those self-talks that make your thinking pattern, that impacts your emotional intelligence. And this is where, my dear sisters, we as women and men as well, how many men we have in the room? A few, three or four. We all are very much impacted by this, but especially women, we are more emotional sometimes. And we tend to tell ourselves things that are not true. And that's why this last half an hour we're going to be talking about this. There was this research in the army in the United States where they wanted to see if they would put these army soldiers in a very stressful situations, and they would be without sleep for 3 days, and they would be totally without, you know, in a cell, without proper rest, without a bed to sleep, and proper food, if they would be able to maintain and make moral decisions if they were captured. So they did that, lack of sleep for 2 days. They evaluated how well they did in terms of their decision making after that. And it was interesting to see that those that had a low EQ, they changed their moral values and made bad decisions. So they gave up. If they thought lying was bad, they lied to be free, you know, that kind of thing. While the ones that had high IQ, they were able to control and make good decisions despite the lack of sleep and stress that they went through. And this is so key, because when we think about the life of Jesus, about the life of Paul and many others that had a lot of stress in their lives, but they were able to be very true to what they believed, we then see that they had a very high level of EQ, right? And so EQ is very key. Aspects of EQ, or emotional intelligence, knowing our emotions. If you have a high IQ, and I really wish we had the time today, because I have a test for EQ, but we won't have the time. We're running, trying to give you this information. That's so much good things that we could learn. But knowing our emotions is key. Managing our emotions. This is all part of emotional intelligence. Recognizing what our emotions are, what we're feeling, it's part of emotional intelligence. And managing very well our relationships. Again, that's why politicians usually have very good EQ. They're able to network and have tons of people and maintain those relationships and manage them very well. You know that, you know, many times people that have EQ, they have much more promotions in their work than the high IQ people who don't have their relational aspect of emotional intelligence. And they're always wondering, how come that person got a promotion? And I'm smarter than they are, and there they go, and I'm here. I know more than they do, and I'm here. And, you know, it's a part of emotional intelligence. It's not so much how much you know and how smart you are, but how good you are in your relationships and in the way you actually relate to people and how you respond to stress and everything else. So emotional intelligence. Oh, very big factor, motivation. People that have high EQs, they have motivation. And many times, you know, if the high IQ person doesn't have that, you can understand why they don't go on and they don't achieve things and they don't accomplish things. Whereas somebody who has a lot of motivation and they're determined, even though they're not so smart, they are able to achieve and go through obstacles and really achieve success and accomplish what they like to do. So this is key. I just want to ask a question. This is part of emotional intelligence. If you look at this lady here, choose at least one or two letters here. I don't know if you can see because of the light. But you think she's bored, hopeful, stressed, afraid, in shock, or none of the above, cannot be determined, or don't know. Okay. How many think she's bored? Okay. How many think she's hopeful? Stressed? Afraid? In shock? None of the above, cannot determine. I don't know. Sounds like the bored one in this group. You want to know what the right answer would be? Actually, the right answer would be either F or G. Why? Unless you talk to this lady and you really find out what's going on in her life, you can look at her and think she is going through something. But that is one type of distortion that we're going to learn about. It has to do with jumping into a conclusion without actually knowing. And this is very common with people that have a very low emotional intelligence. You look at someone and say, she's upset with me. You look at someone and say, they're thinking this and this. They're talking about me. Look, they're talking, looking at me. They're talking about me. And so everything is very negative. So this is what we're going to learn. Same thing here with this guy. Neutral, sad, joyful, curious, in awe. He does look stressed out, doesn't he? Very convincing. But the truth is that you can't really determine. You can have a good clue. You know, this is very interesting because it has to do with cognitive distortions. And we're going to spend most of our time now talking about this. And this is the whole process of the thinking process. It's so common, people. And it's what Vicky said yesterday. A lot of us have a huge problem with our frontal lobe in terms of when it comes to our thinking, because we many times bring this upon ourselves, the way we analyze things. All or nothing thinking is one of them. Let me go back. This distortion is when things for you are white or black. So either you are perfect, and if you do something wrong, you're a loser. It's kind of like, either it's 100 or it's 0. People that are very perfectionist, they tend to fall into this all or nothing thinking sometimes. And they're very hard on themselves. It's one of the cognitive distortions that we have, and we need to be aware. When you see a situation arising, you have to understand that sometimes there is a gray area. It doesn't have to be terrible and totally wonderful. It can be bad, but you can still be okay, right? So this is one of the distortions. Another one, overgeneralization. It's very important. It's part of IQ to be able to generalize things. Something happens, you look at the three situations, say, okay, there's a pattern here. That's generalization, it's appropriate. But when you overgeneralize things, when you look at, two or three circumstances and you say, okay, this is always going to happen this way, that is overgeneralization. And it's very difficult because people suffer with that. An example is, for instance, and actually Dr. Nelly talks about this, this guy comes very shy, asks this lady out. Finally, he gets the courage. And then he said, please, would you go out with me for a date? And she says, oh, unfortunately, I can't. I have an appointment. This guy is overgeneralized now. He's like, you know what? That's it. I'm never going to date anyone. Nobody's going to like me. I finally get the courage to ask her out. She's never going to go out with me. And we do this. I'm telling about a guy, but you know how we women are. We can do that very well. And so what he does, okay, nobody ever going to, I'm going to be a loner. I'm not going to get married. Nobody's going to like me. And so what is the problem with that thinking? First of all, he assumed that she always going to say no. Well, she had an appointment. Maybe next time she'll say yes. The other thing he thinks, overgeneralizes, that every woman has her taste, right? Maybe she did, even if she said no and she didn't want to, other women will say yes. So we have this tendency of sometimes looking at bad situation and say it's going to be horrible and it's terrible. And we just focus on that fixed thinking that Vicky was talking about, it's really, really terrible. And we're just, you know, looking at a situation without hope when that's not the case. We have to go back and look at this distortion. Mental filter, it's another one. When we look at something negative, and they're kind of like similar, but this is actually in this book, Feeling Good, the New Mood Therapy. And he puts it very nicely, these 10 distortions that we can look at. Mental filter is when you have good things happening and everything, but actually you look at the bad thing and you use that to think through anything that happens to you. For instance, you can do a perfect job, but you messed up one thing. And that one thing is what bothers you, and you just forget about all the rest of the good things that you've done, and that bad thing is in your mind. Your husband can come, and he can be a good, caring man in terms of work, and he provides for you, and he's a good father, and all this. But you know what? He forgot the anniversary card and the gift and the date of your anniversary, and that's what you're focusing on. And forever, you're going to remind him, and you're going to say, "Sir, he doesn't love me because he forgot that date." And then, and so you use that as your mental filter. And anytime he comes and tries to, but you forgot, and that's what, you know, you keep focusing on. That's a mental filter. We have to be aware of that. Disqualifying the positive. This is even worse. The mental filter, you focus on the bad. Disqualifying the positive is when you not only focus on the bad, but even when the good happened, you think that's it doesn't count. So you're so looking at the bad that the good is not good enough. And that's very important for us. You know, sometimes we have blessings, but we focus on the bad thing and we say those blessings, oh, they don't matter. And that's something that we need to watch for in our thinking. Jumping to conclusions, that picture has a little bit to do with this because it has to do with mind reading. It's one of the jumping to conclusion type of patterns of thinking. We can't, you know. And as we saw in that picture, only 1 in 4 chances you will be right that person is thinking what she's thinking. Even couples, you know, couples get to know each other, close friends, best friends. They sometimes are able to, you know what one is thinking and kind of, not know, but guess, a good estimate of what they're thinking. Even then, only 4 out of 5 chances that they will be right. Most of the time, you may be wrong. So that's very, very important. We jump into conclusions all the time. And unless we're able to really go through this thinking and say, what? Is this true? What I'm thinking, is this real? Is it really the truth? Or am I just, you know, focusing on something that's not real? It's not what we don't know that hurts us, but what we know for sure, that it just ain't so. You know, so we think we know and we think we're right. It's not true, and that's what is hurting us. Thinking that we know that that's what's going to happen. But if we step back and we look at the big picture, we can perhaps allow ourselves to suffer less pain. Because many of us sometimes are suffering the pains that we bring upon ourselves because the way we think. And that's why this is so important. Now, I just want to mention to you, you know, this is all part of what we call cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, nowadays, there's a lot of medication, and most forms of treatment for depression are medication-based. I treat patients, like I mentioned to you, as a nurse practitioner, and many times, you know, it's the tendency in the medical community is somebody is depressed, you give a medication. That's first line of treatment. Second line of treatment is therapy. If the medication didn't help, and after a month or two, then you say, okay, you need to go to therapy. That's what is recommended right now. But what we see is something that we need to keep in mind. The most common treatments of depression, again, medication, but 70% will experience an improvement of their mood if they are on medication. However, all these people, less than 20% of them, they will be feeling that they are cured from the disease. Now, understand what I'm saying? They have an improvement, 70% of them have an improvement, but less than 20% feel that their depression is cured and or that they are back to what they were normal. The other side of the coin is that 25 to 30% do not improve with medication. They go on with depression for many, many years, 10, 20 years. 50% report side effects. Over half of these stop taking their medication, and I see that all the time. They come back, oh yeah, I stopped taking, you know, because, oh, I couldn't sleep, and then they stop taking the medication. Two-thirds are not very satisfied with their treatment. 75% state that depression continues despite, of their medication intake, and they're having problems in their social life, they're having problems in work performance, and it affects their family. Besides that, there is relapse. After 3 months, there's a 75% relapse rate within 2 years. And another study showed 40% relapse within 1 year. So even those that are able to continue on medication, the relapse rate is 20 to 40%. That's something to keep in mind. But we are not here telling you that medication is not good. Quite on the contrary, medication is very, very important, especially for moderate and severe depression. For those of you that did or will do the self-screening test, if you get moderate to severe depression, you need to contact your doctor and you need to seek assistance, because as we talked, Vicky mentioned yesterday and we've talked before, we need the medication to bring the levels up so that you have the energy and you can focus again on doing some of these things so that you can take care of the causes. Because when you're down, moderate or severely depressed, you don't have the energy to start putting all these things we're learning into practice. And so sometimes, temporarily, the medication will bring the levels of serotonin or whatever your chemical imbalance up so that you can start putting this into practice. So we're not saying that. We need to be using this, though, with caution, not as the ultimate solution to the depression. And again, reserved for moderate and severe. Mild depression is many times helped by the things we're talking about here, and you don't necessarily need the medication. In case of severe depression, all patients are recommended to be on medication until you have your levels, you're feeling better and you're able to live and do what you need to do. Reassess for need and aim for discontinuation within 6 months, because many times if the depression is improved and you're able to do the interventions, to actually focus on the causes, you will feel better, then you can probably later on stop medication, see how you feel. And that's how many times people see that they don't need the medication anymore. As a matter of fact, the NATALEE program, 90% of people that follow through, they are medication free. The medication is discontinued and they don't have relapse. And we showed you some of this before. There are Prozac-like medications, you know, serotonin inhibitors, and these are some of the side effects. Decreased crying, you improve your mood. This is not the side effects. These are the effect of the drugs. Increased social affiliations, but also increases impulsiveness. And that's why people that are suicidal, you need to be very careful when they're on medication, because they feel better and then they may still be suicidal and they can go and take their lives. So, especially in adolescents, there's a lot of controversy, and FDA in the United States trying to look at that, and parents upset because adolescents kill themselves because of this effect. And also, it may cause a don't care attitude. You know, we have known people that their spouse dies, and the woman is on antidepressants, and they have, or vice versa, and they have no reaction. They're kind of numb, because it does impact your emotions and your feelings. So the second recommended one is counseling. But I don't know if you knew this. This was new to me when I first learned about cognitive behavior therapy. Traditional forms of psychotherapy, even though this is what's prescribed, according to this book, Scientific American book, which is a Bible, it's a Harvard, a Stanford book for psychiatrists and psychotherapists, it tells you that traditional forms of psychotherapy, such as Carl Rogers, you know, Rogerian therapies and other, never were proved to be superior to placebo. In other words, they do therapy with this group and they give a pill to this other group telling them you get better. And you go through this regular psychotherapy and you compare the results to the group that was just taking a placebo pill and there was no difference. And this is very important to keep in mind. As a matter of fact, we know that some of those therapies, they even feel worse, because depending on the therapy that they go through, they start looking back at their, you know, childhood, And then the therapist kind of blames or puts the blame on the father, the mother, a family member, and they start blaming their parents, and then that creates hostility, between them and the loved ones, and that's worse for their mental health. Now, we know that cognitive behavioral therapy is different, and that actually research has been showing that it improves. This is a research done with patients that were for 20 years depressed, clinically, severely depressed, without any help or improvement from medication or from any kind of therapy or anything. And they put this group on cognitive behavioral therapy along with medication. And you know, even though they had been on medication and never improved, now after cognitive behavioral therapy was done, 85% of the patients improved. They were very astonished with this. The doctor that directed the study from Brown University said, none of us had anticipated we show anything close to 85% response for that combination. It was really amazing. And so cognitive behavioral therapy focuses on what we're just talking about, the distortions of thinking. It helps you change the way you look at what happened to you so that you will feel different. Not just looking just at the past events and blaming and saying, okay, that's why I'm feeling the way I feel. But it helps people put the focus on themselves and say, you know, I can think differently about this. I can change the way I feel about what happened. And that helps them. So the focus is on you and what you can do differently. That's what this therapy does. And the benefits are that at least is as effective as drug therapy. It also has no physical side effects. It makes relapse less likely. And it makes staying free from depression more likely as well. Changes brain chemistry. And it's also a huge, huge help for phobias, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, anorexia, and bulimia. So this has all been documented. And now if you read, as a matter of fact, the brochure you have on women and depression from the National Institutes of Mental Health, you're going to see cognitive behavioral therapy as a mode of treatment for the part that has to do with this counseling. So what it is a thinking process, how to change your perception. Your cognitions are the way you are thinking about things at any moment. So this has to do with changing that cognition or that way of thinking. And before we know it, we are feeling what we've been feeding our mind. And this is amazing, this connection, because it not only makes a difference in our mind, but it makes a difference in our bodies as well. I'm a failure. Or you may be here and say, I have depression. I've been here listening to this. You know what? This is not going to help me. All this exercise and food and diet, you know what? My problems are real. They're not just in my mind like you're saying. See, this is a person telling herself or himself this. My problems are real. It's not just my thoughts. Or you can say, hey, this is interesting. This is good information. This may help me. See how different? You can be optimistic or you can be pessimistic. Your feelings will do result from the messages you give yourself. Your thoughts have much to do with how you feel than what's happening. You remember the story of Paul and Silas? They were in a prison. They were in shackles. And you know what? They're complaining. God, why did you put us here? We are suffering in your name. And that's what they're doing, right? No, you don't remember the story. They were singing. How could they be singing? It was not what was happening to them, is what they were telling themselves. And they knew God was with them. So no matter what was happening, they were focusing and telling themselves what they knew to be true. So what we think affects who we are. And this is an interesting quote of Ministry of Healing. Many die from disease, the cause of which is wholly imaginary. Our imagination aggravates our problems. If we only thought we would get better, we would get better. Mm-hmm. She's saying that. And this is real. Research is telling us now. So we need to avoid pessimism. Interesting though, this is a group that was studied 224 subjects looking at the people that are optimistic and the people that were pessimistic. The pessimism, actually, that group had more anxiety, more perceived stress, physical disease. So that was a prediction. The optimist group, it didn't predict any problems. They were optimists, they were okay. But if they were pessimists, they had a prediction that they would be anxious, that they would be having physical problems. So avoiding pessimism is important. But more than that, more than thinking positive, see, our time is up. More than thinking positive, and you hear about, think positive, it's more key to avoid negative. And that's why, my friends, all the time, we need to be watching ourselves. You know, this is a key test. It said it is a positive duty to resist melancholy, discontent, thoughts, and feelings, as much a duty as it is to pray. Okay? It's a huge text from Minister of Healing. So if you think prayer is important, it is. But avoiding negative, distorted thinking is just as much a duty. And that's why this subject is so key to women. And that's why we're so excited about this. Because when we start to learn about the distorted thoughts that we have, and we're able to replace those with good, true, accurate thoughts, we're going to change the chemistry in our brain. And God will be able to do more and help us heal faster. So dwell on the good. Avoid pessimism. And don't permit to say anything critical. This is actually an exercise that we do during the Depression Recovery Program. For 14 days, people cannot think or say anything negative. And you have to start all over again if you mess up. So it's kind of telling yourself, getting yourself in the habit. And this is part of being transformed by the renewal of our minds. So key. And so you're feeling bad? You're feeling depressed? You're not smart enough, not pretty enough, not successful enough? You can change the way you feel if you change the way you think. You know, you need to look for elements of truth in what you're thinking. Bad things happen. Nobody's perfect. It will happen every day. But we need to focus on the beautiful promise that God has, because our thoughts can be make us victims, and we don't want to be victims. We are daughters and sons of the King, and we have wonderful promise that He's come to take us. I just want to end to tell you, let me just show you a few quotes here that I think are very important. We already went through some of these. These are other cognitive failures that we have: fortune teller error, magnification, minimization, emotional reasoning. We women do this all the time, and because we're very emotional creatures, that's a gift from God. But we have to control our reasoning. Think you can, think you can't. Either way, you'll be right, said Henry Ford. Obstacles are those frightening things we see when we take our eyes off the goal. And I love Anne Frank saying, I don't think of all the misery, but the beauty that still remains. May God help us, that we may look unto Him, keep our eyes in Him. So we'll have a wonderful way of helping Him heal our minds and have healthy brains, healthy frontal lobes, and get away, and you know, from the depression that we feel. Amen?
Amen.